From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look at earlier terrorist attacks against the United States to get some clues about last week's attacks. We'll talk with New York Times reporters Benjamin Weiser and Ralph Blumenthal. Weiser covered the American Embassy bombing trial this year and the 1997 trial that convicted Ramzi Ahmed Youssef of planning the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Blumenthal covered the 1994 trial of terrorists behind the first attack on the World Trade Center, and he covered the trial of the men who plotted to blow up New York landmarks. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why she keeps reading in spite of last week's attacks, and she recommends a new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week's attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon are part of a decade-long holy war against the United States. Earlier attacks include the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the bombing of American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, and a thwarted plan to bomb New York landmarks, including the United Nations and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels. My guest Benjamin Weiser covered the embassy bombing trial this year. Four men were found guilty of all the charges against them. Weiser also covered the 1997 trial that convicted Ramzi Ahmed Youssef of directing the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Benjamin Weiser covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. I spoke with him this morning. The embassy bombing trial wrapped up in August, and you wrote that the closing arguments for the trial sounded like the opening argument in a future trial of bin Laden if he's ever captured. Would you sum up some of the things that were said in that closing argument?
Well, in the closing arguments of the embassy bombings case in New York, of course, the government was trying to convict and eventually did convict four of bin Laden's associates who were on trial. But in order to do so, they had to prove to the jury satisfaction that he, bin Laden, had led and participated with these men in a global terrorism conspiracy to kill Americans abroad and everywhere around the world, as the government put it. And that really put bin Laden on trial in a way, too. He was not tried in absentia. He has not yet been tried, and the government did not try to prove evidence against him. But they clearly had to show that this conspiracy existed so that they could then show that the four men on trial were members of it. So I suspect we would hear many of the same kinds of arguments and pieces of evidence in a trial in the future if bin Laden was ever put on trial in New York. And I suspect we would see a number of the same witnesses.
So how close did the embassy bombings trial come to tying bin Laden to the bombings? And what were the convicted men's ties to bin Laden?
The four men who went on trial had various ties to bin Laden, some weaker than others. One of the men, and probably the man the government felt was the highest ranking man in his organization, of the four on trial, was an American citizen named Wadi El-Haj from Texas, who the government claimed had been his personal secretary and a close aide, in addition to being an operative who traveled around the world, helped to make false passports, helped to set up corporate fronts for bin Laden in Kenya. At another level, some of the operatives were what you would perhaps describe as much lower members, but who played the role of suicide bombers in the Nairobi attack, although the one on trial did not, in fact, die, and a man who helped deliver the bomb in the Tanzania attack. The fourth man on trial was also an associate who was a member of al-Qaeda, the group run by bin Laden, as the government says, and was also involved in the Nairobi case. So those were the four. In addition to the evidence produced at trial, in a hearing before the trial, the government took a plea from another man who had worked for bin Laden named Ali Mohammed, who, interestingly, was a former American Army sergeant who had served at Fort Bragg, but had also gone to work for bin Laden and his conspiracy. And in that hearing, which took place somewhat before the embassy bombings case began, this was last October, Ali Mohammed said that as early as 1993, he had actually gone to Kenya to surveil American targets for possible bombings at the request of bin Laden, and while there took photographs and other surveillance of the American embassy in Nairobi. Then he said he went back to bin Laden and showed him his file, and bin Laden pointed to where a truck bomb might drive, looking at the photographs. That's actually the closest that they've ever tied bin Laden to the embassy bombing in Nairobi, although they did not actually put that evidence into the trial itself.
I'm wondering if there's anything you see in last week's attacks that seemed to connect in terms of method or technique to the embassy bombings, the trial that you covered. You know, for example, I think in that trial, at least one of the men went to flight school in the United States.
That's right. It's very early in this investigation to make the links that people are making, and they, of course, may be true. We haven't yet seen much of the evidence that the government's collecting that would link this to bin Laden, and if that's the case. But there were a number of things that surfaced in the embassy bombings trial that will really help people understand if this is a bin Laden operation, you know, how it happened. In addition to the fact, as you've just pointed out, that a number of there was evidence in the trial of several of bin Laden's operatives going to flight school in the United States and learning pilot techniques. There is also a great deal of evidence that surfaced in the trial that, to some extent, shows how bin Laden's modus operandi has worked and that of his organization. And we've seen that again in this case. It appears that, you know, a small number of what they call cells or groups of 4 to 5 people were involved in each of the hijacking of the planes, and perhaps receiving support from a larger network on the ground in the U.S. And this is very characteristic, at least the testimony showed in the last trial, of how the organization that he runs works. There was a manual introduced in the trial, a terrorism manual, as it was described, in which the government literally showed that bin Laden's group had instructed its agents to work in small cells to ensure their security and safety, almost compartmented so that no member of any cell would know what other cells were involved in doing, both to protect their own security and the security of the other cells.
What else did you learn about how the cells operate?
The cells were almost hierarchical in structure, at least based on the evidence in the trial. Again, they involved very few people, and each cell was a representative of a different task. Some of the cells would do after an idea was thought up. One cell would do the surveillance of targets, as Ali Mohammed had himself in the Kenya case. Others would plan the operation, and then others would actually carry out the actual attack. And yet others would clean up afterwards and help in the escape. And it was all written down in these manuals. As we mentioned in a recent article in the Times, on page 12 of one of the manuals, under missions required, was a particular section that talked about the blasting and destroying of embassies and attacking vital economic centers. So it's interesting in retrospect as well.
So do the targets come from the top of the organization, or do the cells even decide on who the target is?
The evidence suggests that the ideas do flow from the top, and that they are, the targets are picked at the highest levels. But there's also evidence that the cells can operate on their own once they're activated. In one of the documents that surfaced in the embassy bombings case, this fellow Ali Mohammed, who again acted as a kind of logistics expert for bin Laden and later pleaded guilty and talked in court a little bit about what he had done, described the placing of hundreds of terrorists known as sleepers or submarines, as they described it, who would lie low for years until they were activated. And there's one document described Ali Mohammed's comment that trained terrorists don't order their people to blow things up. Terrorists are trained and then they act. And the characteristic of the operations is long planning and advanced surveillance and meticulous preparation, which could take years and years. And as we saw, the embassy bombings in Kenya were planned at least as early as 93, according to the testimony from Ali Mohammed, which was 5 years before. And that might suggest that today's bombing was planned 4 or 5 years ago, you know, somewhere in the world.
Yeah, the submarines or sleepers, as they were described, these are operatives who are put into place, for instance, sent to the United States, and they just wait there until they're activated, until they're called to work.
That's right. And again, the evidence is extremely scant so far, but it appears that a number of the people who are being identified as suspects in this hijacking case were in the United States for several years, undergoing their training and their schooling and melding into the community with nothing to do except wait.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Weiser. He covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. He covered the trial of Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, who was convicted of masterminding the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. And Weiser also covered the trial of the embassy bombings, and that trial wrapped up in August. Did you learn anything at the trials that you covered about recruiting of terrorists?
One thing the trial showed was that bin Laden wanted to recruit Americans and did because of the ease with which they could travel around the world with their American passports. In the embassy bombings case, at least two or three Americans surfaced. One was the fellow Wadi Ahaj, who was a naturalized American citizen who had worked for bin Laden and was ultimately convicted. Ali Mohammed, the sergeant I mentioned, was also a naturalized American citizen from Egypt.
You know, I've been reading in a couple of articles in the New York Times, in fact, that the profile of the suicide bomber seems to be changing. That, you know, for a while, the suicide bombers seemed to be people who were young, pretty poor, pretty disenfranchised, not very well educated, ready to give their lives in part because there probably weren't a whole lot of options for them. But now some of the suicide operatives seem older. Some of them have families. Some of them are fairly well schooled, and they don't seem to be in the dire straits that the suicide bombers were thought to be in. Do you have any observations about that?
It of course is an important question, because if we can't anticipate the profile of the bomber, it's going to be very hard to find them before they act. Again, Ali Mohammed in the embassy bombings case said that the United States was hampered in a comment he made to the FBI, was hampered in its efforts to stop terrorism, specifically because the profiles it uses to identify potential terrorists are flawed. And also, the embassy bombings trial showed that the people who worked for this organization specifically sought to change their appearance, even in ways that might make them look, you know, less Muslim, shaving their beards, not wearing traditional Muslim dress, specifically so that they would not fit the more physical, descriptive profile at the time that they're moving.
You know, your reporting has described the terrorist network as meticulous in its planning, but you wrote, on the other hand, the embassy bombing trial showed that bin Laden's group was at times slipshod, torn by inner strife, betrayal, greed, and the banalities of life. What are some examples that came up in the trial?
Well, the most dramatic example was the emergence of one of Mr. bin Laden's former top aides, a fellow named Jamal al-Fadl, who ultimately broke with bin Laden and eventually worked his way into the hands of the United States, pled guilty, and became perhaps the most important witness in the trial for the government. I also believe he'll be perhaps the most important witness, one of them certainly, if Mr. bin Laden or other top members of his organization are arrested. And he left bin Laden after stealing money from him because he felt that he was being underpaid and that bin Laden was favoring certain members of his group over others, feeling that the Egyptian members were getting paid better and treated better. Although this ultimately had no effect on the operational capacity of bin Laden, it did allow the United States government, I believe, to see that there were, you know, like every organization, some vulnerabilities that could be exploited. And the government ultimately presented two very important, what they call accomplice witnesses at the trial, people who had worked for bin Laden and left him over some disagreement.
My guest is Benjamin Weiser. He covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter Benjamin Weiser. We're looking at what we learned from earlier terrorist attacks. Weiser covered the U.S. Embassy's bombing trial this year. He also covered the 1997 trial related to the first attack on the World Trade Center. Now, you covered the 1997 trial of the World Trade Center bombing, the one that convicted Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. Just sum up what that trial was about for us to refresh our memory. Like, who was on trial on this one?
In the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, of course, initially a trial was held the same year of four men who had been arrested for actually carrying out the operation. By 1997, the government had also arrested two other men, Youssef, who was largely described as the man who led the operation, and a second man who had driven the truck into the basement garage of the World Trade Center, which carried the bomb. Youssef was convicted in that case, as was the other man, and was ultimately sentenced to prison for the rest of his life. It was an interesting trial because Youssef, at the end of the case, when he was sentencing, got up and gave a speech in the courtroom in which he tried to explain why he had acted and actually did not hide the fact that he was a terrorist. He said, I am a terrorist and I am proud of it, he said. The judge at the time, Kevin Duffy, who's a veteran judge in Manhattan and also somewhat of a scholar of the Quran himself, also talked and accused Yusuf of really betraying his religion. I'm looking at the quote. Duffy said, it wasn't honor or the glory of God or Allah that Ramzi Yusuf took away from the Afghanistan war where he had fought, but it was his enjoyment of death, particularly the death of innocent people, and as he put it, your adoration of the cult of death. And Yusuf complained at one point that he hadn't been allowed to make phone calls to his family, and the judge said, you know, we don't even know what your real name is, and since Yusuf had used dozens of aliases. And the judge said, having abandoned your family name, I must assume that you've abandoned your family also. So they got into quite a back and forth. You know, there's also information that Yusuf, after his arrest in 1995, as he was being brought back to New York by the FBI in a helicopter that was flying over mid-Manhattan and bringing him to detention before he would be actually placed on trial, that he looked out the window and saw the World Trade Center towers, you know, standing, glowing in the city's night. And one of the FBI officials said, look down there, they're still standing. And Yusuf replied, they wouldn't be if I had had enough money and explosives.
Yeah, in fact, you said that this FBI agent quoted Yusuf as saying that he hoped the explosion would have toppled one tower onto the other, killing tens of thousands of people to let Americans know they were at war. It's really terrifying to read that that's what he wanted back in 93.
There's no question that's what Yusuf wanted.
So let's back up a bit. You said that at the 97 trial, Ramzi Yusuf said, you know, I am a terrorist. What did he say to explain why?
This, of course, was not at the trial itself. Just to clarify, he did not testify on his own behalf. But when he was sentenced, before sentencing, everybody has an opportunity to explain themselves. And the judge gave Yusuf an opportunity to explain himself. Mm-hmm. And Yusuf said, to summarize it, you know, in his short talk, he attacked the United States and Israel, the peace process. He described what he called the Jewish lobby, which he contended had paid bribes to American officials to win their influence. He said, quote, this is what you worship, money. Money is your God. Hypocrisy is your courier. That was Yusuf talking. Judge Duffy later said back to him, quote, death was truly your God, your master, your one and only religion. The judge said, he told Yusuf, you claim to be an Islamic militant. Of all the persons killed or harmed in some way by the World Trade Center bomb, you cannot name one who was against you or your cause. You did not care, just so long as you left dead bodies and people hurt. And, of course, six people were killed in the first World Trade Center bombing. More than 1,000 were hurt. That number is very small, of course, compared to this past week.
Many terrorist experts have said that even if we do get bin Laden, the terror network would likely continue to exist, that by getting rid of bin Laden, you haven't destroyed the network. Did you learn anything at the trials you covered about the other powerful people who are perhaps as number two or number three who might be ready to take over if he's captured?
There was a great deal of evidence about his organization, who were his high-ranking aides, what their nationalities were and how they operated. There was no indication necessarily that these high-level aides had access to the same kinds of money or even were able to inspire followers the way bin Laden did. And I think it just seems to me to be too early to say precisely, you know, who might take his place. But it doesn't seem likely to me that when the United States says that it wants bin Laden handed over, that it means it only wants bin Laden handed over. I have to assume that they're asking for bin Laden and many of his closest aides.
Given the kind of training and ideology and religious fervor behind the terrorists, is it harder for the government to turn terrorists into witnesses?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer, but I think the evidence shows that even with the intense dedication that bin Laden's followers gave to him and his organization, that ultimately the government was able to turn at least two people who were presented at trial. Ali Mohammed, his former top aide, did not testify, but obviously provided a lot of information to the government and pleaded guilty. And there were other lower-level people who testified and had pleaded guilty. So the evidence is there that they were able to do it, and I have no doubt that they'd be able to do it again. But it's clear that the government has to look hard for these people, and I'm sure it's a combination of luck and skill and good investigative work to find them. I think some come to us and some we find.
What's the incentive that a terrorist might have to turn and become a government witness?
In the case of Al-Fadl, Jamal Al-Fadl, who until the trial had been described in a very mysterious way as CS1 for Confidential Source 1, and ultimately became the major government witness, against bin Laden, he ultimately was on a run for his life. He left bin Laden, as I mentioned, after stealing some money from him, getting into a financial dispute, and ultimately left. He ultimately ended up in the hands of the United States for his own protection. And I think a lot of people who might be recruitable by the United States, at least in the sense of participating as government witnesses, may fit that category.
Benjamin Weiser covers the federal court in Manhattan for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Chasing the Hawk, Looking for My Father, Finding Myself, a memoir by Andrew Sheehan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the foiled attempt to blow up New York landmarks in 1993. We talk with journalist Ralph Blumenthal of the New York Times. He covered the trial of the terrorists who planned the attack, and he covered the first trial related to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews a new novel that she says fits the tone of the times. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking at earlier acts of terrorism against the United States to see what clues they offer about last week's attacks. My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. He covered the first trial related to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. Terrorists planned to follow that attack by blowing up several New York landmarks, including the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels and the United Nations. But that plot was discovered and foiled. Blumenthal covered the conspiracy trial in 1995, which ended with the convictions of a blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who headed a radical fundamentalist mosque in New Jersey, and his co-conspirators. Ralph Blumenthal has also covered organized crime for the New York Times and currently writes about arts and culture. I spoke with him earlier today. What are some of the major connections you see between the first World Trade Center bombing and last week's attack? Connections that might help us understand what happened last week.
Well, the important thing to understand, Terry, is it is one war that we've been fighting against terrorism really from 1990. It's come in different forms and not always been recognized. But, for example, World Trade Center 1, as we now unfortunately look back on it, also relied on a small group of very secretive extremists who used all the trappings of spy craft, secret meetings and coded telephone calls and false identities. And the links actually persist, if not the same players, to the current plot.
Are there any people connected to the first World Trade Center bombing who seem to be connected to last week's attacks?
The simple answer is no, because they're in jail. And from jail, where they are around the country in maximum security prisons, they have no opportunity to communicate. So the actual people who participated in or carried out the first World Trade Center attack are no longer on the scene. Okay, but there are links because it's a complicated world of relationships. There are links between the first World Trade Center attack and even plots predating that, and the current attacks.
And what are those links?
The links really go through this Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who is now in prison. Who was the leader, as a jury determined, of the attack, first attack on the World Trade Center, a subsequent foiled attack, a series of attacks on New York City landmarks, and his spiritual guidance, really, or terroristic guidance, that lay behind Osama bin Laden, who is now believed to be the mastermind behind the latest attacks. So there's really a continuum of people. It's like a relay race. The same people don't appear at the beginning, at the end, but they're in touch with people who are in touch with people who end up doing the final, the most recent attacks.
So the Sheikh Rahman was an inspiration to bin Laden?
He was, and one of the reasons given for bin Laden's terrorism activities is that he was angered over the prosecution of the Sheikh.
The prosecution of the Sheikh subsequent to the World Trade Center bombing of 93.
The prosecution of the Sheikh, right, in the World Trade Center bombing, and particularly in this plot to blow up the Holland and Lincoln Tunnel and the UN and various other landmarks in New York.
Do you know how much is known about the relationship that they've had, bin Laden and the Sheikh?
I don't know, because they really come from different parts of the Arab world. The Sheikh is Egyptian, and he was actually tried and acquitted in the assassination of President Sadat of Egypt. Bin Laden's background is Saudi Arabian, but they came together, at least ideologically, in the same war on America.
Now let's get to the foiled plot. You covered the trial on of the leaders of this foiled plot. What was the plot?
The plot was really chilling. It was to stall some cars in the Holland and Lincoln Tunnel. The cars would be packed with high explosives, as the truck was that blew up the World Trade Center shortly before it. The people driving these cars would have 10 or 15 minutes to get out of the tunnel. Traffic would, of course, back up in the tunnel. The tunnels would explode and water rush in, and everybody would be drowned. This attack was to have been coordinated with an attack on the United Nations and other landmarks, including, they talked about, the Empire State Building, Grand Central Terminal, Times Square, predominantly Jewish jewelry district. So it was a very wide-ranging plot.
What did you learn during the coverage of the trial of how this conspiracy was foiled?
Well, it was foiled by something that the government unfortunately did not have in any of the later cases, which is a very high-level mole or informant
directly in the plot. This man was an Egyptian intelligence agent, a very enigmatic character himself, who claimed to have had prior knowledge of the first World Trade Center attack. Anyway, he had penetrated this group. He became very close to Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and was able to record conversations. He was actually in the tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, with some of the conspirators at the time they were planning the attack, and he had that on tape.
And so exactly when did the government intercede to stop the plot?
It was about a few months after the World Trade Center attack. The first World Trade Center attack was February 26, 1993. The foiled attack, or the would-be attack on the bridges and the UN, was to have taken place several months thereafter in what we now know is a sort of a 1-2 punch strategy of these terrorists. So it was to have taken place shortly after the World Trade Center attack. But this time, at least, the government was aware of the plot every step of the way. And in a very dramatic part of the story, they seized the conspirators in the process of mixing explosives in a warehouse in Queens. They were actually preparing the bomb.
What did you learn about the Sheikh's motivation in wanting to blow up New York landmarks and murder so many people?
Well, the first thing about the Sheikh is it's very interesting. Like bin Laden, he was very careful to maintain an outward distance. He was very, very careful not to say anything publicly that would indicate he was behind this or encouraging these attacks. But he was convicted on testimony and taped conversations that showed very subtle backing or direction that he was giving underlings and giving them sort of spiritual guidance that this is what was demanded of them, this would be permissible. In terms of his motivation, he was part of the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Egypt. They've had a long-running war with the secular government of Egypt, it really grew out of the fight, the battle going on in Egypt that was being carried over here. Abdel Rahman, for example, tried to recruit this informer to kill President Mubarak of Egypt when he was visiting New York. So it really grew out of ideological strife in Egypt.
You've covered the mafia in New York,
right.
And you've also covered terrorism trials, two really different kinds of operations. But there are some similarities in that in both you're looking for informers if you could get them. There's a code of secrecy. It's hard to get people to testify against their own. Can you talk about some of the similarities differences?
It is curious that there is a parallel. I just noticed today that the terrorists had a way of changing the spellings of their names, which is not that unusual considering they're often transliterated from the Arabic. But one of the old techniques of the mafia dons and soldiers was to change their names periodically, just a letter or two here or there, which meant that all the files weren't concentrated in the same place, that they were spread, you know, among three or four different spellings of the names. So we see that here, that it really makes the job of tracking them much more difficult. They use terror among themselves on each other to force associates to submit to very rigorous discipline. There is the code among the omerta, the code of secrecy among that they pledge to enforce their conspiracy with death. So you know, there's not that much difference in the methodology and the just the way they go about things.
What are some of the differences in the tools that, that the federal government has to go after the mafia versus going after terrorists?
Well, the mafia, you know, they have the government was in a very good position to penetrate the mafia because they had a lot of Italian-American agents. We've had a lot of experience in so many years of watching organized traditional organized crime that the government had gotten some very remarkable people like you know, Joe Pistone and the Donnie Brasco story, who actually lived as a high level, you know, mafioso inside the mob for 5 years. We don't have that, as far as I can see, with the terrorist cells. When I covered the World Trade Center 1, it was clear that the government had a great shortage of Arabic speaking FBI agents who could penetrate. So that's probably the biggest single thing. We don't have the intelligence. Sadly, we see the evidence of it now.
My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. He covered the first trial related to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and he covered the thwarted conspiracy to blow up New York landmarks. You know, I've been asking you to try to make connections between previous terrorist plots and last week's attacks. Any other connections you'd like to make for us?
Yeah, there's one very big one. In 1990, the leader of the Jewish Defense League, Meir Kahane, was assassinated in New York. And at the time, the attack was seen as an isolated extremist attack by a Muslim fanatic named El Said Nosseir, who was convicted of a weapons violation, of having a gun. It was a strange jury verdict. Anyway, he turned out to be the center, or a center, of the World Trade Center conspiracy originally to bomb the World Trade Center. And he had terrorist links to many of the groups that are showing up and showed up since then in terrorist plots against the city, including the foiled plot to blow up the Hudson River tunnels and the UN. This was a missed connection, we all now realize, as far back as 1990. And he's now in jail. He was convicted and is serving a long sentence. But the inability to see that that assassination was really one of the opening gun in a 10 or 12-year war that is still going on is one of the big intelligence failures.
You work at the Arts and Culture Unit of the New York Times now. What aspects of the terrorism story are you still pursuing?
Well, I'm helping out on the intelligence part of it. We're still trying to piece together the pictures of the conspirators, and that's really the hardest part of the story because they've left very few clues. I mean, there are a lot of impacts of the story on the cultural life. I had a story the other day on how building projects, including the reconstruction of Lincoln Center, which was to have been probably the largest cultural project in the nation's history, $1.5 billion plan to revive and renovate Lincoln Center, is probably going to be stalled, if not totally junked now, because of the need to put resources in Lower Manhattan. A lot of other projects are going to be stalled. A lot of plays and books have been held back now because the subject matter is deemed inappropriate at this time. The ramifications are just getting wider and wider. Somebody said the other day that the people who were saving the newspaper of the attack were really on the wrong track. The paper that everyone should save is the paper of September 11th, which is the last day of the old world. Everything is different now.
What were some of the things that went through your mind, having covered terrorist trials and realizing probably pretty quickly that this was an act of terrorism?
Well, my first thought was, oh, no, not again. because the first one was a hellish experience, just from the standpoint, you know, quite apart from the death and destruction. And remember, the first attack, we only had six dead and 1,000 or so injured. I say only, which seem very paltry numbers now against this tragedy. But it was a hellish experience to cover, because, again, we were dealing with a lot of shadows. It was a very competitive story to cover. Everybody was running around. A lot of rumors were floated. We didn't have the experience that we have now, actually, on how to cover these kind of stories and where to look. So in that sense, we're a little better off today because we do have sort of a framework now.
What are some of the more practical things you learned during covering the trials about how the terrorist cells operate, their methods?
Well, first of all, like the mafia, they're not always as good as they try to be. They make a lot of mistakes, thankfully, they certainly have to talk. You know, the mafia has to talk to plan their activities and figure out what they're going to do with the money. So they have to have meetings. They have to talk on the phone, whether it's in code or not. And so do these guys. And every time they make a phone call, they leave a track. And there are phone records that are very, very helpful on establishing these connections. So that's the one thing you see, that even the best laid, you know, plots have big flaws. Now, in World Trade Center 1, the huge breakthrough was finding within days of the explosion the truck chassis that carried the chassis of the truck that carried the bomb into the World Trade Center garage, and that, with the identification number on it, led to the car rental company Ryder, and they could trace it to the particular office that rented the car and the people who rented it. So right away, within days, they had that connection, and that was not something that the conspirators ever thought would happen that quickly. Here too, in this case, they have found obviously the manifests of the planes, and some of they found a passport already. And as soon as they have this list of names, they're going back over their residences, their circle of acquaintances, the telephone records. What we're learning is that the FBI can move with great speed in putting putting the picture together once they have a little evidence to go on.
Now, you mentioned that the conspiracy to blow up New York landmarks was foiled because there was an insider who spoke to federal agents. Do you know what his motivation was? Did that come out during the trial?
Imad Salem, the Egyptian intelligence officer who had penetrated this group, partly it was financial. He was looking for $1 million payoff, which he got, I believe.
He got it from the feds?
Yep. And this is often the attraction for people who turn on their associates. That's why they put out these huge rewards. Often with these turncoats, they enjoy the game. They like the excitement of being a double agent or an undercover agent, and so there's a sort of a psychological thrill to it all for them, especially since the stakes are so high. I mean, if they're unmasked, they face death. So he was a complicated character, and in his case. But, other people turned, too, during the trial. Two of the people facing charges in the Landmarks plot turned government witness and testified against their cohorts. So it did happen a few times.
It seems that the FBI and the CIA have some tough choices to make in terms of who they're going to put on the payroll for information, people who might still be terrorists, who might still be working against
them. Yeah, those are very unpalatable choices. And just as they... they take mafia informants, people who've been involved in murders. Look at Sammy the Bull. He became the darling of the prosecutors because he turned against John Gotti, and he himself had killed, I believe, 11 people or more, 19. The count keeps changing. So these are tough choices that the government has to face all the time, and we're used to that in our society. You have to deal with these people because ordinary law-abiding citizens don't have this information. They're not privy to it. So you have to deal with the people who are in the middle of it. You know, one of the really interesting choices that the government had to make in the case of the informer and the Landmarks case was whether to bring him out to testify or to leave him undercover. He wanted to stay undercover. He didn't want to be exposed as a witness. But there was a big argument over that, and the forces that made him into a witness to testify won, and that had certain consequences, and perhaps if he'd stayed undercover, he might have exposed this plot. We don't know.
Ralph Blumenthal, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ralph Blumenthal is a reporter for The New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan on continuing to read and to teach. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan is still reading, and she recommends a new book that seems to fit with the tone of this awful time. It's called Almost, and it's by Elizabeth Benedict, who also wrote Slow Dancing, which is a finalist for the National Book Award.
You could see the Pentagon burning from my classroom windows the morning of September 11th. Since then, given the sights that we've all been witness to on our TV screens, it's been hard to concentrate, to read, to teach. 2 days later, when my classes at Georgetown resumed, I stopped into the office of one of my colleagues, who's also a native New Yorker, to share the shock. I said to her, "All this makes what we do pretty irrelevant, doesn't it?" My colleague is wiser than I, so she replied, "No more irrelevant than it ever is. We're always teaching and learning within the shadow of our own mortality." Her remark reminded me of something my father once told me, about how on the destroyer escort he served on during World War II, there was a makeshift library, spottily stocked with the classics and adventure stories. Distraction, sure, but basic nourishment for the mind and spirit as well. So it's with the recognition that books will have to be necessary cargo on our national voyage into the implausible that I offer you a book review. Fortunately, it's a review of a very fine novel. Elizabeth Benedict's novel is called Almost, and like many another emotionally profound and richly textured story, it sounds schematic when you try to summarize it. That's because the great life of this book arises out of Benedict's judicious and sometimes startling mastery of language. The casual dialogue here and the descriptions of the ordinary remind me of Raymond Carver's short stories and poems. Nothing phony, nothing literary, nothing done, at least so you'd notice, for effect. Take that nothing of a title, Almost. The little word echoes and grows more ominous sounding as you read and realize that it's the perfect way for Sophie Chase, the main character here, to diagnose herself and her life. The story opens on Sophie and her boyfriend Daniel having passionate sex in her New York apartment. At an orgasmic moment, the phone rings. It's a policeman from the Martha's Vineyard-type island of Swansea, where Sophie, until recently, used to live. He's breaking the news to her that her husband, Will, has been found dead in their house. Sophie walked out on Will some months earlier, and she's in the midst of divorcing him. So she's almost a wife, almost a widow, or a widow manquée, as she calls herself. She's also almost a stepmother to Daniel's 4 adopted children, whom she loves, almost a mother to Will's adult children, and almost a writer. She's had one serious novel published years ago, but since then she's been ghostwriting celebrity autobiographies. the theme of people impersonating their lives or being too drunk to face them. A lot of the characters here are, like Sophie in AA. All of that sense of loss intensifies when Sophie returns to Swansea. There we learn more about Will, who was a CIA operative in the 1960s and a man undercover throughout his whole life. As the mournful days on the island pass, Sophie comes to realize that Daniel is also not a man who emotionally shows up. When they first met at an AA meeting, she asked him, "Where do you stand on God?" "Off to the side," he answered, "quite a way." It turns out he stands off to the side when it comes to getting deeply involved with lesser creatures, too. For a story that mostly takes place on a remote island over a few days, a lot happens. Sophie drinks herself into a roaring tantrum at a high society clam bake. An old lawyer friend who puts her up becomes embroiled in a sex scandal. One of Daniel's kids runs away in New York. And Will's awful first wife and his two daughters show up and haggle with Sophie over who owns the corpse. There are also some laughs here of the gallows humor variety, mostly supplied by Henderson, Sophie's gay friend who arrives to give her support. All right, despite what I said earlier about Benedict's Raymond Carver-like adherence to the real, Henderson is a contrivance. It seems like every other gay man in fiction or on TV these days has to justify his existence by trying to be as funny as Oscar Wilde. But then again, I was so amused by Henderson's jocularity that I'm tempted to give his presence a pass. Almost is structured as an autobiographical novel. It's the novel Sophie writes about her life after she returns to New York and resolves to live more fully, more aware. Its prevailing tone, apart from Henderson's interjections, is melancholy, sober. Maybe that's why, despite the fact that it's a small story, a self-absorbed story, it's a story that also seems in measured accord with these solemn times.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Almost by Elizabeth Benedict. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, from PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises, starting in October on Friday nights at 9. Local times may vary. And from Random House Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publishers of Paris to the Moon by Adam Gopnik, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our examination of last week's terrorist attacks and their aftermath. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.